Number 1.
Back when I was a med student, I received an internship at a local hospital. To start, they positioned me in the lowest possible rung of the ladder, and I was stationed downstairs in the morgue. In case you don't know, hospitals keep corpses on ice until they are identified, released, or said to be transferred. I wasn't thrilled, but I didn't complain. If I wanted to succeed, I had to start somewhere, so I took the unpleasantness in stride. Fortunately, I got paired up with my friend and fellow student, Mike, which made the job much more tolerable. Normally, we worked the day shift for 8 hours, and our assignments consisted of transporting dead bodies as they came down to us, and storing them in compartments in the freezer. It wasn't enjoyable at all, but it wasn't exactly back-breaking work, and I learned more by doing this and interacting with the professionals than reading from a textbook. After a short while, Mike and I were switched to the night shift. By this time, we weren't as uncomfortable, and the pay was slightly better, so we happily accepted. At night, the building was much more quiet, and the body transfers weren't as frequent, so fighting boredom was the hardest part of it all. We eventually pulled out some cards and played some blackjack to kill time. I could feel the exhaustion starting to wear on me. We weren't used to the night shifts yet, and our internal clocks hadn't adjusted. Mike noticed my eyes sagging. "Hey, how about you go catch some sleep? I'll wake you in an hour." I thanked him, and I passed out for a short while. After I woke up, I was stiff and sore, and it felt like I could have slept for another several hours, but it was Mike's turn to get some rest. So reluctantly, I lifted myself up off the cot and let him lay down. After a minute, he was out cold. I made myself some coffee and was about to play some solitaire with the forgotten cards, when a redheaded nurse came running in from the hallway outside to inform me that another body was ready to be transferred. I got up quickly to help, glad that there was finally something happening. I was slightly confused as to why the nurse had physically come downstairs to inform us. Normally, they just placed a call to us that someone was coming down in the elevator, but I didn't dwell on it for long. I met the attendant by the elevator and took the gurney with a sheet-covered corpse from him. He then said, "Sorry, I just kind of dropped in on you like this. We didn't have a chance to place the call." I responded, "It's okay, one of the nurses came down here and told me." He looked at me in confusion before getting back into the elevator. I found that kind of odd. I shivered in the cold as I tried to align the gurney just right alongside the others, and one of the arms fell out from under the cover. I bent over to reposition the arm and tossed the sheet back slightly as I set it back in place. A lock of red hair caught my eye, and my stomach dropped. I pulled back the sheet to reveal the face, and what I saw shocked me to my bone. It was the nurse that had just came to tell me that a body was coming. She had been alive not 3 minutes earlier, yet was stone dead right now in front of me. I wasn't sure if I was crazy or if the whole thing was a joke, or if I had just encountered something paranormal. But whatever the reason, I was freaked out, and I was not having it. I woke Mike up, panting and wheezing and screaming like a baby. After explaining the situation, Mike gave me a confused look. "Well, that's weird. Is that the nurse that you're referring to?" He pointed behind me at the doorway, and I saw the same redheaded nurse peeking out from the hallway. She disappeared back into the darkness without saying anything. I felt the bitter coldness crawl up my back, and my legs gave out from beneath me. Mike ran to try and catch the nurse, but couldn't find her. We both left the basement and took the elevator back upstairs to the security office. After reviewing the footage of the stairways and elevator, it was determined that there was no nurse, redhead or otherwise, that had gone downstairs the entire evening. When I went home that night, I lasted 15 minutes before I realized I couldn't be alone. I went to my brother's place and stayed for the entire day. I then called the hospital and asked for a shift change. And when they were unable to comply, I quit. Mike transferred out as well, and I've never been back to that hospital since.
Number 2.
Several years ago, while studying to become a surgeon, I took a part-time job in a morgue for a short time in the hopes that I would get to study the human body in fairly substantial detail. I got to see all sorts of things regarding the anatomy of a cadaver, but my main interest was always the heart. I saw numerous types of hearts, from healthy to diseased. I learned a lot thanks to the job, which I'll always be thankful for. However, my time was brief for a good reason. I came into work one evening and began doing my usual inspections, ensuring the refrigeration units were all working and that all the bodies were organized, when I noticed something odd. One of the bodies that had been put away the night before wasn't in its compartment. I instantly panicked, as losing corpses is never a good thing. I started checking each of the units. We had 30 in total, and each one had a complex unlocking process, so it took me over an hour to work through them all. Thankfully, the last unit that I checked contained the body. Relief washed over me. However, I was the only person with access to the morgue, and my manager was on a month-long holiday in Australia, and security was tight, so it would be extremely difficult for someone to break in. I put it down as my own error eventually. I must have been exhausted from the long days I was working alone. I finished work early the next morning and left to go home. About 10 minutes into my journey, I realized that I had left my phone back at the morgue. I made my way back, unlocked the place, and headed inside. I was checking the reception area when I heard a loud bang. It came from deep within the building, in the direction of the morgue. I grabbed an umbrella for the sake of having a weapon and made my way down the corridor, checking each office door as I did. Bracing myself outside the door to the morgue, I summoned enough courage to open it. I froze. A corpse sat in the middle of the morgue, staring at me. It was a fresh body that had only been brought in earlier that night. I remained still, a high-pitched ringing filling my ears as my head swam. Then the corpse moved. It fell over onto its side. I jumped back, brandishing the umbrella, and waited. I knew it wasn't alive. I had checked all the vitals earlier. There was no reasonable explanation for this, other than there was an intruder playing a sick joke. I carefully approached the corpse and briefly checked it. As expected, it was dead. I had the keys to each office except my manager's and began an investigation of the building. After my search turned up nothing, I approached my manager's office and looked in as best as I could through the opaque glass. I noticed nothing out of the ordinary and checked to make sure the door was securely locked. I put the corpse back in its unit and left. The whole ride home, I couldn't shake the image of the corpse from my mind. I wasn't bothered by the dead like most people, but the way the corpse was positioned and the way it stared at me gave me the creeps. I realized in hindsight that I should have just called the police, but for some reason I was unable to think logically at the time. The next day, I received a call from the police as I drove into work. They told me that they required me at the morgue as soon as possible, as there had been an incident. Upon arrival, I saw several police cars with their lights flashing, scattered in our parking lot, and my stomach turned. What could have happened? A policewoman approached me and asked to see my identification card. "We've got a situation. Can you come inside with us, please? It seems like someone broke in overnight." She led me inside and straight down to the morgue, and I counted 10 bodies that had been removed from their units, sitting, standing, and lying around the morgue, all positioned to be facing the door. The rest of the day was a blur. I was taken in for questioning by the police. They weren't naming me as a suspect yet, although they did tell me there was no sign of forced entry, and they were still trying to figure out how the perpetrator got in. All the bodies in the morgue, even those that were still in lockup, were taken away for forensic examination, and the morgue was placed on lockdown. The next few days I spent drifting around my house aimlessly, utterly confused by what had happened. On the fourth day, I got a phone call from the police, giving me an update. The forensic team had finished their analysis of the bodies. Each one had been sexually abused. A wave of nausea washed over me, causing me to vomit. By day 7, I was allowed to return to the morgue and started getting things back in order. I was reluctant to go back alone, but there would be constant police surveillance on property, so I felt somewhat assured. The police had left the offices in a real mess after their sweep, so I spent most of the day cleaning up. Late into my shift, I walked past my manager's office and noticed his door had been left open after the investigation. He was very private about his office, and likely wouldn't be thrilled at returning to work from vacation to discover it had been ransacked. I peeked inside and noticed that his drawers had been rummaged through, and papers were scattered across his desk. As I returned the papers to his desk, as neatly as I could, I noticed something in one of the drawers, and my heart sank. It was his passport. As I left his office, I heard a door slam from across the hall. And almost immediately, all the lights in the building went out. I found an emergency flashlight at the reception desk. I was about to head out to the fuse box when someone's voice came over the loudspeaker and began cackling in an insane, demented, and malicious way. I grabbed my belongings and quit right then, telling the police as I pulled out there was an intruder inside messing with the lights. I never went back, though the police came to my home for further questioning. No one was ever found inside the building, and my former manager never returned from his trip. Of course, I told the police about the passport in his desk, and we all agreed that he had likely never even left.
Number 3.
Back in the 1980s, I used to work at a morgue in Juneau, Alaska. Most of the bodies that came through our doors were victims of logging accidents, animal attacks, or extreme cold. It was very tedious and not very rewarding, but it was also isolated and quiet, and given that I was in trouble with the law down amongst the lower 49, I decided to keep my head down and try to enjoy the Alaskan night sky for as long as possible. Most of the year I worked alone, but for about 6 weeks in the dead of winter, I was usually assisted by an older native Alaskan doctor. His full name was very long and elaborate, and meant something along the lines of river running swiftly, but I just called him Rick. Now the night in question I remember very clearly. I recall that I was sick as a dog, hacking up phlegm every 15 seconds. I had a fresh tattoo of a golden eagle on my shoulder and forearm that was still raw and constantly itchy. My truck had recently blown out its transmission, so Rick gave me a ride to the morgue. Soon enough, we were playing poker while watching a VHS copy of The Sting on a small TV in the back room. I remember leaning back and stretching and coughing hard into my sleeve. I dragged the trash can over and spat a thick wad of mucus into it. Rick glared at me and said something along the lines of,
"Such appalling behavior. It's no wonder you're alone in the world."
"Well, I'm not alone, you dick. I always have you."
"Only for as long as the winter lingers. Besides, even though I endure your company, rarely do I cherish it."
That's how Rick commonly spoke, with a noble expression like he was expecting someone to chisel his words in stone. We spoke for another few minutes about something or another, and I poured us some more coffee, when we received a call from the local police that a fresh corpse was on its way to us. We turned on the outside lights and prepared the autopsy room for arrival. When we saw the headlights coming up the driveway, we met the attendants at the front entrance and signed all the paperwork. The form stated that the body was male, of indeterminate age, anywhere from 30 to 50, and had been found in the basement of an elderly couple's antique shop. Once Rick and I had our gloves and masks on, I remember adjusting the lamp and pulling the sheet back. Rick gasped. My first instinct was that it had to be a joke. I even poked at the body a few times to make sure it wasn't some kind of movie prop. Before us lay a completely hairless man, roughly about 6 feet tall, with pale white skin and ashy gray teeth. The teeth were one of the first things I noticed, because the man's lips and cheeks had been torn clean away, revealing the tender facial muscles and the diseased gums. The man's eyes were missing, and the dark pits of his eye sockets stared upwards past us towards the ceiling. There was no bruising or damaged tissue anywhere around the eye sockets to indicate the eyes had been violently cut out. If anything, they seemed to have been removed with such surgical precision that there was barely any indication that the man had ever had eyeballs to begin with, which was in stark contrast to the lower half of his face, which did appear to have been violently removed. I felt the shiver run down my spine as I took in the sight. With the eyes missing and the jaw exposed, it certainly gave the impression of a leering skull. Rick leaned forward and opened the jaws carefully. How does it look like it was removed? Cleanly or violently?
Violently. It doesn't look like it was cut, it looks like it was ripped out.
After further examination of the body, we discovered that the genitals had also been removed, though so methodically careful that there was barely a scar where the skin had healed. There were several small green thorns punctured into the lower back, and two of the fingernails on his right hand were missing. What was even more strange was that rigor mortis had set in so completely that we were unable to move any of his limbs without shifting his entire body. The fact that he was as stiff as a marble statue made no sense to me, as his internal temperature suggested that he had been dead for less than 6 hours. Where was the body found again? I asked as I flipped back through the paperwork, and after a moment, I found the details. The body had been discovered by the building's owner in a cold, damp basement, behind a dusty old sofa. There had been no signs of forced entry. I looked up at Rick. Any ideas? He shook his head. Maybe he was imprisoned and drugged, just to be tortured.
Let's open him up. Try to determine the COD.
Over the course of the next few hours, we made a Y incision into the flesh, opened up the chest cavity, and removed all of his organs, which, at least to the naked eye, appeared to be normal. We took samples of the thorns on his back and cut open his head to examine the brain. Overall, aside from the brutal wounds inflicted to his face and groin, there were no signs of trauma or damage to any of his internal organs. His stomach was full of food. It appeared to be chili and crackers, indicating that he had eaten a fairly good meal not long before he died. We ran a few blood tests for any signs of poison or radiation, but all came back negative. I was at a loss. I looked over to Rick, who was standing there, arms folded, head to his chin, staring down at the corpse with stubborn gray eyes, like he was trying to solve a Rubik's Cube. Rick was the type of scientist who would lose sleep for days over this riddle, but I only tolerated the job for the paycheck, and I was ready to give up, confident enough with myself that we had done a thorough examination, very professionally. I'm ready to throw in the towel. This is clearly beyond our pay grade, and I'm tired of looking at his fucking ugly mug. Ready to call it a night? He gave me a look that said more clearly than any spoken words that he wasn't satisfied. But I didn't really care. I was miserable. My throat was sore from all the coughing. My head was spinning. I knew it would take us at least another hour to clean up the lab, and all I wanted to do was go home and sleep. Unfortunately, Rick was my ride, and I wasn't in the position to leave until he was content to abandon the examination, at least for the short term. I don't recall exactly what he said, but we talked for a short while longer. I finally convinced him that I would call another medical professional I knew in Anchorage the following day, who would be able to tackle the case with fresh eyes. Rick reluctantly agreed, and we began cleaning up. We sewed the corpse back up, locked it in an open compartment, and washed up. We shut off the lights, and while Rick was rewinding the movie in the VCR, I checked the day's paperwork and did a final sweep of the building, checking all 4 exits to make sure they were locked up tight. Rick started mumbling that he had misplaced his driving glasses and began rummaging through the drawers looking for them. It was below zero at night, and I was starting to put on multiple layers of clothing when I heard a harsh rapping sound coming from the back in the lab. Imagine the sound of someone nervously tapping the point of their pen against a metal baking tray. That's what it most reminded me of. I asked Rick what that could possibly be. He shrugged and cast a skeptical look back towards the lab. We waited for a moment for the noise to stop, but when it didn't, I sighed and walked back down the hall, back into the lab. I coughed a few times as I turned on the lights, and almost the moment I did, the tapping stopped. Part of me wanted to leave right then. Whatever the problem was, it had solved itself. A cautious whispering in the back of my mind was telling me to check the body. I walked over, unlocked the cabinet door, and peered in. I had loaded the body feet first, so I was looking down his body past the top of his head, and for a moment, nothing appeared to be disturbed. until I noticed a glint of light reflecting from within. Rick's glasses were clasped in one of its hands. I remember whispering something along the lines of, "What in God's name?" And without thinking, I reached in to retrieve them. That was when the pain started. It was bad. It was the worst pain I ever felt in my life. I screamed so loud. Rick came charging through the doors like a mother bear coming to aid one of her cubs. I'm not sure what he saw at first, my face or the blood. Probably the blood. There was quite a bit of it. I reached my arm back as hard as I could, and the cabinet's tray slid out with it, as the corpse's teeth bit down hard through my thick jacket and into the flesh of my arm. Rick tried to pry the corpse's mouth away, but when he found himself unable to do so with his bare hands, he grabbed a fire extinguisher, brought it down hard on the lower jaw, breaking the bone and sending teeth flying. I nearly dragged the body off the sliding tray with all my flailing, and when the grip was released, I fell backwards onto the ground, blood pouring down my fingers. Rick wrapped my arm with his belt, just above the elbow, as a tourniquet, and dragged me from the room, me screaming like a shark had attacked me. Rick called the ambulance as I lay on the couch in the foyer, gritting my teeth and trying to comprehend what had just happened. Suddenly back down the hall from the direction we had just come from, I heard coughing. But not just any coughing. It was my own being echoed back at me. Rick and I froze as we heard it start to grow louder, as if whatever was making the sound was coming towards us down the hall. We booked it out of there. Rick and I leapt into his truck and made for the hospital, meeting the ambulance about halfway there. I was admitted immediately, which was good, because I had already lost the feeling in my arm. I needed a blood transfusion and 50 stitches by the time everything was finished. Just over a 3-inch long strip of flesh, at least a 1/4 inch deep, had been torn clean off my right forearm, and one of the teeth was still lodged in the wound. Rick left the hospital to meet the local cops back at the morgue. They arrived before he did, and entered the building when they heard a man's loud screaming coming from within. They found the body lying in the hallway, broken jaw hanging limply off the face, and what appeared to be a soft ball-sized hole in the chest cavity, where it looked like something had torn itself free from within the body. Whoever, or whatever had made the screams, was never identified. The body was bagged and transferred out of our jurisdiction. We never saw it again. Rick and I packed up our belongings and left Juneau the following week, neither one of us wanting to set foot in a morgue again. I moved to Canada and got a job in the logging industry. The experience had left Rick badly shaken. He returned home to his family and found religion. He raised sled dogs afterwards, and we kept in touch until he died of pneumonia in 1998. I'm in my 70s now, and I rarely talk about that night. My niece convinced me to write this story down and share it online. I still carry the scar on my right arm. I tell people who ask that I was bitten by a dog. I occasionally still have vivid nightmares about that night, but time has dulled their impact on me. If I could only have one question answered about that entire night, it wouldn't be how the corpse wound up in that state, or even how it managed to bite me and wander down the hall on its own. It would be, what did we miss during the autopsy that broke free and escaped from within it?
There's always a reason to be afraid.